you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. I'm joined this week by critics Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, from Cinegods.com, Wade Major, and the New York Times film writer Amy Nicholson, who also hosts the podcasts Unspooled and Zoom. We begin with the horror thriller The Conjuring: The Devil Made Me Do It, the latest chapter in the series. Patrick Wilson, Vera Farmiga star in the film, directed by Michael Shavs. David Leslie Johnson McGoldrick and James Wan are the writers. Amy, what did you think of The Conjuring: The Devil Made Me Do It?
Oh, let's talk about it. I mean, so The Conjuring franchise, as people listening out there probably know, it expands beyond The Conjuring. You know, this is the fictionalized exploits of this real-life married couple called the Warrens. And sometimes they're dealing with a doll named Annabelle. That's the whole other Annabelle franchise. Sometimes there's a creepy nun. There's a nun franchise as well. But no matter what, they're always together, they're always dealing with Satan, and they're always wearing polyester pants because these things are set in the 70s and 80s, which makes me endlessly happy looking at the costume design. I mean, Vera Farmiga's collection of ruffled blouses in this movie is just amazing. The story here is that it takes place in 1981, and the couple is exorcising a little boy, which is pretty standard for them, except to get the demon out, the boy's older sister's boyfriend tells the demon to take him instead. And then a few days later, he murders somebody. So the Warrens now want to see if they can not just defend his body against the devil, but if they can argue to the court that the devil did make him do it, if they can defend him from death row, which I think is a pretty fun premise, although there's not that much actual courtroom behavior in here, which is sad. Like, there are a couple court scenes. I was really excited to see them try to take the stand. That doesn't happen. Instead, it's mostly them figuring out where the devil came from and who summoned it and figuring out who else could be guilty for this murder or for whatever made him do the murder. I'm not a fan so much of how this franchise executes its scares. It's mostly jump scares. They're pretty just loud and they're predictable. I don't find the films frightening, but I will say the Warrens themselves, just as this like daffy retro couple with their updos who look quasi-Victorian, but also like the Brady Bunch, they just kind of grow on me at this point. They're just dorky, and I like watching them hang out. And it's nice to have a horror film that's centered on a good marriage. That's more interesting than anything.
The Conjuring: The Devil Made Me Do It. Wade.
Yeah, I love the marriage, too. I think Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson have wonderful chemistry, especially after three films now. They just kind of know each other, and they just work like hand in glove, and it's really nice to watch them that comfortable and to see the love between these two people be sort of a central part of the story. That's really unusual for this genre. It's important to note too, I think James Wan has graduated away from directing these. James Wan directed the first two. He hands this off to Michael Chavs of La Llorona, which a couple of years ago was a bit of a horror hit. And he does a very good job. He's very different from James Wan. James Wan is a very traditional kind of horror filmmaker with the creaking doors and the perspective and some of the tools that we've become accustomed to in his Saw films in particular. What Chavez does here is much more sort of dreamlike and fantastical, and it immerses us much more in the visions and in the otherworldliness of it. And that's a nice change. We it feels like the franchise has graduated a little bit. We've grown the Conjureverse, if you will. Outside of the Annabelle films, I'm not such a fan of these films. The main three, I actually like a bit better, but it is, I think you also have to know that what they take from real cases is very, very skeletal. The most interesting stuff in this movie is purely fictionalized. All of their investigative procedural stuff, who did it, how that all transpired, that is all completely fabricated. The backstory of the kid, the exorcism, and the murder, that stuff is true. Everything else is just completely fictionalized.
The Conjuring: The Devil Made Me Do It is rated R. It's in wide release and available to watch at home on HBO Max. Spirit Untamed, an animated adventure, directed by Elaine Bogan and Ennio Torresan. Charles, what do you think of Spirit Untamed?
Well, about 20 years ago, 2002, DreamWorks did Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron, which I don't know was a great movie, but did have some really interesting animation by James Baxter and Press Romanillos. 20 years later, we get a sequel that sort of has a horse that looks the same in it, but the stories have nothing to do with each other. And it plays like a really cheesy direct-to-video sequel. You have not one, not two, but three spunky girl heroines who seem to be out to tell kids who are watching, don't listen to your parents, go out and risk your lives, because it might be fun and it might be exciting and you'll prove yourself. There's some dreadful songs in the background. One of the girls sings and it's all about be courageous and be who you are and prove yourself. They outwit a gang of outlaws who are trying to take these wild Mustangs to be worked to death. The animation was done all over the world and it looks it. The gestures are weird. The mouth shapes are odd. There's one sequence where the horses look like they're being operated by somebody in an old vaudeville horse suit. And I used to think Jake Gyllenhaal was an actor who couldn't give a bad performance, but after this and Okja, I've moved him to the naughty list. So I guess the point of it was to try and sell horse toys to little girls who love horses, but it's a pretty dismal film.
Spirit Untamed, Wade.
Yeah, I largely agree with everything that Charles has said. It's a very, very peculiar and belated sequel to a film that I didn't think was that inspired in the first place. And the CG is just a real step backward for DreamWorks. It feels like they've gone to some kind of a very bargain basement, rudimentary school of animation that has no connection whatsoever to what DreamWorks was building through those first early years of Katzenberg. And this is just a very misbegotten movie. I didn't find the characters engaging at all. I think the script is incredibly weak and substandard and formulaic, and it's charmless. And if horses are such amazing creatures, you have to sort of step up and at least measure yourself by what they are in real life. And these horses are just not engaging.
Spirit Untamed, Amy.
I'll defend this movie. I liked it better than these two guys. I mean, I can really picture the 10-year-old girls at a slumber party where this film would be like the biggest hit. And I hope that their parents rent this movie for them. You know, I think this has a nice dynamic in there about the friendship that this girl, Lucky, and when the friends that she makes when she lives in this Wild West town, the idea of like how people sort of come together, how they get along. I think there is good teamwork in here. I mean, you can see the strings of them trying to make a film that is very much like young girl empowerment, but honestly, young girls like empowerment and young girls like horses. And I think these two things tag team together really well. I mean, it does feel a little simplistic on the surface, but I don't have a problem with that in this one. Like, and I also really expect that in this whole franchise, the horses don't talk and they keep that authenticity of them allowing them to be silent horses. And yes, sure, they make a lot of meaningful eye contact, but they are still at the end of the day horses, and the film respects that about them. So you guys are being cranks.
Spirit Untamed is rated PG. Elaine Bogan and Annie Otorasan are the directors of the DreamWorks animated film. It's in wide release. Edge of the World tells the story of adventurer Sir James Brooke. The film stars Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. It's directed by Michael Houseman and written by Rob Allen. Wade, what'd you think of Edge of the World?
This is the surprise of the week. I didn't know anything about this story. I had not heard of the movie, and it is absolutely terrific. This is a great old-fashioned epic adventure throwback movie that is about an extraordinary historical figure that I'd never heard of before. James Brooke was an English explorer who went to Borneo in the late 1830s, early 1840s, and wound up becoming Raja of his own kingdom there as he tried to sort of settle all of these political conflicts centering around the Sultanate of Brunei. And he tried to put an end to slavery and to piracy and headhunting and all of these things that were really plaguing the people at that time. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers has never been better. He has aged into a new kind of a shape as an actor. He had so many, you know, he played those pretty boy roles for so many years when he was younger, and now he can be more grizzled and really play a much more complicated character. The amazing thing about this guy is this is literally the figure that Conrad wrote about in Lord Jim, And he's also a figure who inspired largely much of the story in The Man Who Would Be King by Rudyard Kipling. So he's really an amazing figure historically. He's inspired great literature. And there was originally supposed to be an Errol Flynn movie scripted by Errol Flynn in 1936 that never happened. So at long last, Sir James Brooke gets his due on film. And it is really a terrific film. Excellent screenplay, by the way, by Rob Allen, who is a novelist and a kind of an all-around bon vivant who formed a company specifically to make films in Southeast Asia and has a lot of expertise in the area. So it feels incredibly authentic, and it is really an old school epic in the grand fashion.
The film is Edge of the World, starring Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, Michael Houseman directing. Rob Allen wrote it. It's unrated, and you can see it on demand platforms like Google Play and Fandango Now. All Light Everywhere, a documentary directed by Theo Anthony. Amy.
Yeah, this is the sort of film where you want to take a friend to see it and you want to sit down afterwards over coffee, over wine, and talk it out. Theo Anthony is this really interesting documentary filmmaker who makes the kind of films that literally have a bibliography in the credits. Like, he is this cerebral thinker who makes kind of these mood pieces. His last one, Rat Film, he used studying the history of rats in Baltimore as a way of talking about redlining and racism. And his documentaries don't make an argument. They just sort of gather facts and leave you there to talk about them afterwards, to kind of pull apart everything he's saying and fit it together. And here in All Light Everywhere, because he's a Baltimore-based filmmaker, he's talking about policing. He's talking about our theories about what peacekeeping can be. And he's talking about the role that cameras play in that. And he centers it by going and doing what looks like a documentary on this company called Axon. And if you haven't heard of Axon, they are a very big name in the world of policing. They make tasers. They make 85% of the body cameras that most police forces use. And he goes there to their offices where they have like an eye scan to get inside the building. And he interviews the CEO about everything that they're doing. And he's talking to him about, you know, learning the limits of perception. You know, the idea that the body cameras, say, for example, that Axon makes, they choose in development not to use infrared in these cameras so that the camera will only record what the officer will see. And they're doing that very specifically, assuming that these tapes will then be taken to juries, and they want the jury to see what they say the cop couldn't see. And so they're using these ideas of what images we decide to show and how we interpret them. And then he jumps around to talk about everything else. He talks about how the invention of the machine gun inspired cameras and filmmaking in general. He talks about scientists trying to map the transit of Venus in the 1870s from the information they could gather about the motion of the sun. He talks about the history of mugshots and identification. He talks about war pigeons with cameras attached to them. I mean, he talks about everything. And we go all over the place. We even go to a meeting in Baltimore where community leaders are debating whether or not having, you know, what they're calling like the eye of God in the sky, like surveillance footage, surveillance drones, will it help the community or will it hurt the community? It's an incredibly complicated, wonderful, chewy documentary that I just think raises so many things to talk about and pull apart and discuss. So I love Theo Anthony. He's the biggest nerd I know making documentaries, and I appreciate all of his films.
Which, that's tough competition in documentaries, right? So
The best nerds on the planet make documentaries.
Absolutely. All Right Everywhere is Theo Anthony's film. It's at the Landmark Theater. Then next Friday, it opens at Lemley's Playhouse 7 in Pasadena. City of Ali, a documentary about Muhammad Ali's relationship with the town where he grew up, Louisville, Kentucky. Graham Shelby is the director. Charles?
Well, at the risk of damaging my role as the crank on the show today, I quite liked this film and learned a lot from it. I did not know that much about Muhammad Ali's upbringing. They have a number of people who were neighbors, who are relatives, who worked with him, who knew him, talking about his growing up there and his funeral, which was apparently this enormous event in Louisville. His widow and his daughter are both wonderfully articulate and give you real insights into the man, into their knowledge of him. The time they spent together and how people responded to him and then to his death. And it's often quite moving. It is a little bit long. I really don't think they need the kitschy Leroy Neiman drawings of him in there or the interview with a soi-disant artist who decided to scatter rose petals in the path of the funeral procession. But a very interesting film. Again, I learned a great deal from it, and was quite taken with it.
City of Ali is unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. We'll be back with more on Film Week. It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. And we're joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. Our next film this week is set in Los Angeles. The crime drama Gully stars Kelvin Harrison Jr., Charlie Plummer, and Jacob Lattimore. Nabil Elderkin is the director and Marcus J. Guillory the screenwriter. Wade, what'd you think of Gully?
I'm lukewarm on it. It's very stylish. It's impressive in many respects. It just doesn't seem to go anywhere conclusive. It doesn't seem to say anything really meaningful or particularly substantial. It is an exercise in style. Nabil Elderkin, big music video director, making his directing debut here, very impressively put together. But it just sort of is like 48 hours of nihilism in the lives of these three kids who all come from troubled backgrounds, three teenagers in Los Angeles. And it's sort of their progressively nihilistic rampage over the course of 48 hours. And again, doesn't really come to a point other than to say, if you come from a really bad family background, this is how bad things can be. I will say Kelvin Harrison Jr., who plays one of the three, is astonishing. So even though I'm lukewarm on the film, Kelvin Harrison Jr., who made Loose and Waves a few years ago, two very different performances even from this, his character is mute in the film but narrates it, so you hear his interior monologue throughout the film. And he is breathtaking. He is if he was not on your radar before, put him there. He is in Meryl Streep and Daniel Day-Lewis rarefied air as an actor. He is the next generation. He is huge. Look for Kelvin Harrison Jr. to do big things in the future.
We're talking about the crime drama Gully, set in Los Angeles. Amy, what did you think?
Yeah, to Wade's point, the cast is what had me really excited to see this film. You know, Kelvin Harrison, I second everything that Wade says about him. Also, Jacob Lattimore in here, he's an actor that I've really liked watching ever since I saw him in the film Slight. There's Zoe Renee. She's a young, talented actress. She only has a couple of scenes in here. She was in a movie called Gin a few years ago. Jonathan Majors, of course, from Black Blessed Man in San Francisco. It feels like, you know, Nabil Elderkin really had his pick of, I think, the best of the best of this new wave of young talent that's been coming out. And then the film doesn't really do much about it. You know, these boys are all kind of sociopathic and they're traumatized in their own ways. They have this video game that seems like it's going to play a part of the film early on, where they're playing a video game where the characters look like themselves. And I thought that was such like a funny, fun, clever idea. Then they go out and start playing the video game and they begin to embark on this rampage where I was like, oh, this is trying to just reset Clockwork Orange in the present in Los Angeles. I am completely okay with this. Like, show me what you're going to do, even if it's a little bit ripped off. And then it just suddenly about faces and decides that it's a film that's really about like friendship. And you're like, oh, really? I don't think you're actually a film about friendship. So the plot here didn't really work for me at all, but I really adore this cast. And I do believe that this director is going to do something great. This is just an example of like raw talent looking for a good direction to funnel its energy.
The director is Nabil Elderkin. Gully is rated R. It's in select theaters, including the Cinemark 18XD near LAX, the Cinemark 22 and IMAX in Lancaster. It's also available on demand platforms starting in a couple of days. On the Trail of Bigfoot, The Journey, a documentary directed by Seth Breedlove. Charles.
Well, this is what happens when somebody who watches Ancient Aliens on TV gets a hold of a video camera.
Is that you or the director of the film?
Well, Breedlove and his family and some of his family members and friends decide they're going to look for Bigfoot in the Adirondacks. And they, again, this sort of TV sensationalism, they talk to so-and-so, author and researcher, blogger and researcher, local person who saw something one night. These people are not anthropologists or biologists or ecologists. They keep trying to compare the Adirondack Forest to the Pacific Northwest. Well, one is a broadleaf deciduous forest, the key species of which have been decimated by plagues, so it's not an unspoiled environment where something could have come back. They've also been cut and reforested about three times versus a virgin coniferous rainforest in the Pacific Northwest. There are people saw something with red eyes. There are, maybe this could be, could this possibly be? It's silly. It tells you nothing. These creatures don't exist. So of course they don't find anything. And why bother?
Now you spoiled it. On the Trail of Bigfoot, The Journey, a documentary from Seth Breedlove. It's unrated and it's available on multiple on-demand platforms beginning next Tuesday. Undina is a German-French co-production, a fantasy romance starring Paula Beer, Franz Rogowski, and Mariam Zeri. The film's written and directed by Christian Petzold. What did you think of Undina, Amy?
Yeah, Christian Petzold has made this kind of reputation of making these films about interesting, complicated, screwed up women wrestling with love and betrayal living in Germany. His last one, Phoenix, which is superior to this, is about a woman who's a singer in World War II, and she survives the Holocaust in Berlin after being in a concentration camp, only to get like reconstructive plastic surgery and go on this like mission looking for the husband that she thinks betrayed her. Like that was a fantastic film with a lot of plot. This one, he's trying to tell a story about one of the really simple myths that has been told in Berlin, the myth of Undine, who's like kind of a water nymph. And her curse of a sort is to wrestle with the idea of love and falling in love with mortal men. You know, in some versions of the curse, if she gets married, then she loses all her powers, but she gains a human soul. And this myth of Undine kind of got reworked into things that we know more familiarly, like The Little Mermaid. That context is really important because Christian Petzold, in telling this film and setting it in the present day with a woman named Undine who falls in love with two people, he doesn't want to tell you any of that backstory. Like, he assumes you know all of this going in. So he's made a film that's kind of like an imprint of a fairy tale, where if you know the fairy tale, you can kind of see what he's doing, even though he's taken out all the beats and all of the revelations and all of anything that might make it make sense. You're just looking at his reworking of a known tale. To me, not being incredibly familiar with this tale ahead of time, I wanted more of this than I was getting. You know, it starts strong with this idea of her as maybe a vengeful killer. And her performance as Undine, Paula Beer herself, is really interesting. I like that she has this job as a tour guide of ancient Berlin, which lets her have these speeches about history, about things being torn apart and rebuilt. And yet I felt frustrated. I don't feel like this film came together with a point the way that I have expected from a Christian Petzold film. So it was a bit of a disappointment.
We're talking about the film Undina. It's unrated, starring Paula Beer. Wade, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same ballpark as Amy, I think. Petzold has made some very, very fine films. Phoenix is a great film. Barbara from 2012, which won him the Silver Bear at the Berlin Film Festival, is a fine film as well. This is kind of minor Petzold. If you don't know that it's based on a fairy tale, on sort of European familiar myth, you won't follow this film at all. It will make no sense. It will take these weird turns from being very naturalistic into being surrealistic, and then you'll wonder what does that mean, and it'll just confuse you. If you know that it's based on the fairy tale, it's kind of an interesting take on it. It puts an interesting fairy tale veneer on modern life and has some sort of salient metaphorical comments about romance and love and loss and all of those things. So, I mean, if you kind of do your homework a little bit going in, and people don't like to do homework going into movies, but if you sort of know that going in, I think it can be enjoyable, but not amazing. I would actually, as far as movies about this myth, I would refer people to Neil Jordan's Irish take on it, Undine, from some years ago, which I think is a much stronger film.
We're talking about the unrated film Undine, which is written and directed by Christian Petzold. The film is in the Lemley Theaters in multiple locations and available on several on-demand platforms. The romantic drama Grace and Grit stars Mina Suvari, Stuart Townsend, and Mariel Hemingway. The film's written and directed by Sebastian Siegel. Wade, I understand the film is based on the love story of philosopher Ken Wilber and his wife here in California in the 80s.
That is correct. Ken Wilber, kind of a fascinating academic philosophical figure who still has quite a following. This is based on their lives, how they met, the tragic, it's not a secret anyway, but the tragic way in which cancer sort of enters their relationship and how they cope with it. It's done in a very sort of meditative style. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. It's based on Wilber's book, written and directed by Sebastian Siegel, who's making his directorial debut here. And it's very ambitious, but it doesn't really feel as though there's a narrative direction to it. You kind of know where this movie is going. It's sort of set in stone just based on the genre. And if you know anything about Wilber and his wife and their relationship, it doesn't go anywhere new or surprising. Even emotionally, it doesn't really unearth anything. So you're sort of along for a very, very familiar ride with a few stylistic flourishes here and there. But I didn't dislike it. I just wasn't especially wowed by it. I would say for people who know if you've read the book, if you know who Wilber is, then perhaps the movie is a bit more interesting.
Talking about Grace and Grit, written and directed by Sebastian Siegel, starring Mina Suvari, Stuart Townsend, and Mariel Hemingway. It's rated R. It's in select theaters and on-demand platforms. The documentary Super Frenchie tells the story of extreme athlete Matthias Gero. The film is directed by Chase Ogden. Charles.
Well, directed is kind of a strong verb to use in a film this shapeless. Giraud likes to jump off cliffs with a parachute, sometimes with skis. He never really gives you much of a reason why he does this or how you train for this or what's involved in the sport. Solo, which I wasn't wild about to begin with, explored much more of that. This has about the depth of a fortune cookie announcement. Oh, you feel alive. Oh, you reach your soul. I don't know. And he has a bad fall at one point. He gets blown by winds into the cliff in one of the Alps. He gets a concussion, breaks his leg in two places, a couple of days before his wife is about to give birth to their son. And you think, well, what sort of dimbulb is doing this at that time anyway? And then 6 years later, he goes back to confront the cliff. And I guess the cliff was impressed because he doesn't get banged up this time. It's really pointless.
Super Frenchie, documentary on Matthias Gero, the film directed by Chase Ogden. It's unrated in select theaters and on-demand platforms, including Google Play, iTunes, and Fandango Now. Also this week, the documentary Breaking Boundaries, The Science of Our Planet, John Clay directs. Wade, quick thought on this?
Yeah, this is climate porn. We get this every few years. It's mostly based on the theories of Johan Rockström, who's a Swedish climatologist, and it's designed with very scary animation to sort of put you in that same place that we've been in many, many other climate films. The problem is it spends an hour telling you why we're doomed and then very quickly tries to wrap up in 13 minutes what we can do about it, much of which doesn't sound very realistic. I would much prefer that people watch the other Netflix documentary, Kiss the Ground, which is all about solutions and practical reality.
We're talking about Breaking Boundaries, The Science of Our Planet. Amy.
Yeah, that's what upset me too, is that this documentary opened up by saying, like, this is going to be a story about hope. And I was like, great, I could use some, because I believe everything in these documentaries. I'm very worried about things like the loss of biodiversity, especially in bugs. I'm very worried about the ocean becoming acidic. I'm worried all the time. And so I was like, great, Attenborough, what do you know? I know you know the powerful people. Tell us what to do. And then at the end of the film, he's like, eat less meat and half your own emissions. And I'm like, me halving my own emissions? Like, sure, I'll eat less red meat. I'll do all of that. But really, I don't believe you. You know, I lost all trust for this film, which is hard. I don't want to be mad at a documentary that I agree with, but it's hard to know who this is for. who needs to be convinced at this point by a documentary that actually doesn't tell the people who do believe what to do about it, really.
Charles, what do you think of Breaking Boundaries, The Science of Our Planet?
I wanted to give the filmmaker a hit upside the head because he doesn't seem to trust his subjects. There is all this needless animation of funny shapes that I guess are supposed to be neurons interrupting the visuals. You know, I already don't eat red meat. I've planted a dozen and a half trees in my yard. Is that going to save the planet? No. And repeating these same silly animations of people not terribly convincingly walking on what seem to be sort of glass panels as they approach the tipping point doesn't tell us much of anything. So I'm with Amy and Wade on this one.
Breaking Boundaries, The Science of Our Planet, the film directed by John Clay. It's rated PG and it's streaming on Netflix. Coming up, we have more to talk about on Film Week. I have another film to review. We'll also get some recommendations for things streaming that you can see at home. And we'll remember a terrific animator, Charles Solomon, had the pleasure of knowing as well as admiring his work. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Welcome back to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by film critics Wade Major, Amy Nicholson, and Charles Solomon. Next up is Bad Tales, a film that's set in the suburbs of Rome. It's directed by Damiano De Innocenzo and Fabio De Innocenzo, who are brothers. The film starring Elio Germano. What'd you think of Bad Tales, Amy?
Yeah, this film is almost like if Goli was transplanted to Italy. Like, it's about a group of young kids who are all being raised by parents, specifically dads, who are completely screwed up, weirdly obsessed with their sex lives, damaging them in all sorts of ways. And then the kids sort of go out and run wild, run amok, do very self-destructive things. But it's done in a style where it's trying to be one of those like European art house films that's all about the comic grotesque. It feels like they made this film to try to do an art film like Dogtooth about bad parenting and about the way that parents shape and influence and control and manipulate, but without actually really getting into any of like the conditions that scenario raises or like really even the psychology of it. And so you're just really watching kids who, I'm bad with kid ages, they might be 11, I don't really know, you know, be put in bad situations, talk about whether or not they should have sex with each other, you know, have their dads give them condoms. It's a very bizarre movie, you know, have these interactions with like, one of them has a neighbor who's a pregnant teenager and she's just like this angry bleach blonde disaster who also seems like she's maybe willing to prostitute herself. Like, I have no idea what this film is actually trying to say. And it's a disappointment because it has an interesting framing device, which is the narrator has found a diary that was written by one of the little girls that we see in the film. We're never quite exactly sure who, which makes it interesting. And he's struck by all of the things he can tell she's leaving out of the diary. So when you feel like this film is trying to fill in that world, the idea of like things left unsaid, it's interesting. But honestly, it just feels like shock tactics done with kind of a raised eyebrow.
We're talking about the Italian film Bad Tales. It's unrated and it's in select theaters, also on Lemley's Virtual Cinema and at the Monica Film Center. Flashback is a dramatic thriller starring Dylan O'Brien, Hannah Gross, and Emery Cohen. Christopher McBride, the writer-director. Amy, you also saw Flashback?
I did. Oh, man, I landed on the grenades this week because this is also pretty boring and I'll get through it quick. Flashback is one of those films where you meet, a man who's duller than dull that we're supposed to care about for some reason. He's an adult. He's married to a wife he doesn't seem to like very much. He's working a soul-sucking corporate job where it's all talks about efficiency tabulations while dealing with the fact that his mother is, you know, hospitalized with severe memory loss. She's, you know, he's losing her. And yet, we're supposed to care about this guy for some reason. And what he keeps doing is flashing back to his memories of high school, where he and his friends all took this drug, Merck, which looks like an aspirin where somebody just scribbled on it with a Sharpie. And he starts picturing this girl that he went to high school with, who's played by Micah Martin, I think. She's a really great young actress. And she becomes just like this manic pixie dream hallucination to him, because every time she shows up in his memories, she talks like Rucker Hauer at the end of Blade Runner, And he's like, what happened? Why have I blocked this girl out? But it's really just a movie where, like, she's magical. Every other woman in his life is like a screeching drag, and nobody cares about him in the first place.
Flashback is rated R. The film is available on video on demand, multiple platforms.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.